As time goes on, we start to see Jewish infiltration and subversion of the ANC. And in 1963, it consisted of Lionel Bernstein, Bob Heppel, Dennis Goldberg, Arthur Goldreich, Hazel Goldreich, and James Cantor, with a few African frontmen: Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Govan Mbeki, Raymond Malaba, and Ahmed Kathrada. The ANC followed the model the Jews established when they founded the NAACP in the United States, with the exception that the ANC was a much more violent and openly communist organization. These Jews and their now-controlled African National Congress received funding and support from both the Soviet Union and the U.S. CIA. In particular, Ruth First, the Jewish wife of Jewish Soviet KGB Colonel Joe Slovo, a leader of the South African Communist Party, was primarily responsible for funneling funds to this African National Congress. By the 1970s, the Jewish campaign to subvert South Africa was having no effect. The economy was unaffected by sanctions and communist unrest was minimal, though much was made of it in the Jewish-owned elements of the U.S. press. Slovo had been the planner of many of the ANC terrorist attacks, including the 1983 car bomb that killed 19 people and injured many others. Slovo, who had traveled to the Soviet Union many times, was awarded a Soviet medal on his 60th birthday. Slovo is a dedicated communist, a Marxist-Leninist, without morality of any kind, for whom only victory counts, whatever the human cost, whatever the bloodshed. Slovo disputes little of his image as the communist mastermind behind the ANC's armed struggle. For him, the fears of South Africa's whites are both a measure of the ANC's growing strength and a crucial factor in hastening what he believes will be its ultimate victory. Revolutionary violence has created the inspirational impact that we have intended, and it has won for the ANC its leading position, Slovo said. The hatred for whites increased daily, and soon the blacks were singing songs taught to them by Slovo and his radical cohorts about how they were going to kill the Boer and kill the racist.
Bulala, bona la mabulu. Manta!
Mr. Mandela, can you tell us how you feel visiting this spot at this time?
It is a very emotional moment for us. That those who are fighting for democracy, for peace, for love among South Africans should be mowed down.
Once more turned its back on whites in South Africa and told them that if they didn't like it there, they should leave. But where were they to go since the whole world despised them? The ANC tried to convince the public that the MK terrorists were actually freedom fighters. Hotels, restaurants, and many other public places were bombed on a regular basis. Riots would break out across the cities with many killed. In 1983, the Church Street bomb was detonated in Pretoria near the South African Air Force headquarters, resulting in 19 deaths and 217 injuries. The bomb was set to explode at rush hour to maximize casualties of white women, children, and babies. During the next 10 years, a series of bombings occurred in South Africa, conducted mainly by MK. In the 1985 Amanzi Mtoti bombing of the Natal South Coast, 5 civilians were killed and 40 were injured when MK cadre Andrew Sibusiso Zondo detonated an explosive in a rubbish bin at a shopping center shortly before Christmas. In a submission to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, TRC, the ANC stated that Zondo's act, though understandable as a response to recent South African Defense Force raid in Lesotho, was not in line with the ANC policy. Zondo was subsequently executed. In the 1986 Durban beachfront bombing, a bomb was detonated in a bar, killing 3 civilians and injuring 69. Robert McBride received the death penalty for this bombing, which became known as the Magoo's Bar Bombing. The subsequent Truth and Reconciliation Committee called the bombing a gross violation of human rights. McBride received amnesty and became a senior police officer. In 1987, an explosion outside a Johannesburg court killed 3 people and injured 10. A court in Newcastle had been attacked in a similar way the previous year, injuring 24. In 1987, a bomb exploded at a military command center in Johannesburg, killing 1 person and injuring 68 personnel. The terror campaign continued with attacks on a series of soft targets, including a bank in Roodepoort in 1988, in which 4 civilians were killed and 18 injured. Also in 1988, a bomb outside a magistrate's court killed 3. At the Ellis Park Rugby Stadium in Johannesburg, a car bomb killed 2 and injured 37 civilians. A multitude of bombs at restaurants and fast food outlets, including Wimpy Bars and supermarkets, occurred during the late 1980s, killing and wounding many people. The area of Wimpy was specifically targeted because of their perceived rigid enforcement of many apartheid laws, including excluding non-whites from their restaurants. Several other bombings occurred with smaller numbers of casualties. This tactic was abandoned due to the high rate of civilian casualties, especially amongst black laborers. The ANC estimated 30 landmine explosions resulting in 23 deaths, while the government submitted a figure of 57 explosions resulting in 25 deaths. It is a common misconception that the ANC's leader in the 1994 South African elections, Nelson Mandela, had been jailed for his political beliefs. He was in fact acquitted of treason after a 4-year trial, but rearrested a few years later and sentenced to 5 years imprisonment for launching an armed insurrection as founder and commander-in-chief of the MK. In his book, Long Walk to Freedom, Mandela says he signed off on many acts of terrorism, including the Church Street Massacre. He told the black youth of South Africa to burn down their schools and refuse to learn Afrikaans, producing a lawless, unemployable generation. But in the rest of the world's eyes, everyone thinks he is a true hero. Mandela conspired not just to bring down the government, he was planning on killing tens of thousands of civilians in his quest for power. He was later charged with 193 counts of terrorism for sabotage and for trying to smuggle, prepare, or manufacture mostly Soviet bloc munitions, including 210,000 hand grenades, 48,000 anti-personnel mines, 144 tons of ammonium nitrate, 21.6 tons of aluminum powder, and 1,500 timing devices. These multiple charges were not trumped-up political charges. In his eloquent closing statement to the court, Mandela candidly admitted his guilt on the charges of sabotage, adding that he was, if need be, prepared to die for his ideals. It was apparent from the huge amount of smuggled explosives that he was not planning to die alone. The judge at his trial commented that personal ambition may well have played a role in his plans. Mandela was never tortured during either of his interrogation or incarceration, as he undoubtedly would have been in a black African nation. Even Amnesty International refused to take on Nelson Mandela's case because they asserted that he was no political prisoner, but had committed numerous violent crimes and had a fair trial and a reasonable sentence. When Mandela was incarcerated, he was given a nice house to live in that was not only comfortable, but luxurious. He had free access to telephone and a fax at the expense of South African taxpayers, which allowed him to organize the ANC from jail. This is why Mandela was still their leader upon being released from jail. He was supposedly in jail for more than 20 years. Not only did he encourage terrorism against whites, but he and his wife Winnie Mandela implemented a torturous practice called necklacing. For any black dissidents, they would have a mob of ANC blacks beat the dissident, put a gas-filled tire around their neck, and light it on fire, all the while making it impossible for the victim to escape. President P.W. Botha told Mandela back in 1985 that he could be a free man as long as he did one thing: publicly renounce violence. Mandela refused. The bottom line is that Nelson Mandela never publicly renounced violence, and we should never forget that. Towards the end of Mandela's time in prison, he began talks with the government. When President Botha suffered a stroke and was forced to resign, F.W. de Plour took the reins. Mandela and de Plour made parliamentary moves to pave the way for the ANC to get together and negotiate. When Parliament opened that following February, de Plour announced that all political parties were to be unbanned and all prisoners released. On February the 11th, 1990, Mandela was freed. Upon Mandela's release from prison, he and Winnie divorced, and he had to pay millions of dollars in settlements. The obvious question is, where did this money come from if he had been sitting in jail for decades? Mandela then moved into an even more luxurious house in Johannesburg, but kept a small shack in Soweto for when he needed to do interviews and appearances. This way he could create the illusion that he was poor when he was anything but that. In 1989, a year before Mandela was freed, Frederick de Klerk, a Freemason with ties to B'nai B'rith, the Jewish Masonic fraternity which controls the ADL, was elected president of South Africa. President Frederick de Klerk was a Jewish-backed candidate with ties to the International Zionist establishment. De Klerk worked for and eventually achieved the Jewish goal of black rule in South Africa. Supposedly competing with the ANC for a say in the future of South Africa were de Klerk's National Party, as well as the rival Inkatha Freedom Party, headed by Zulu Body, led by Chief Buthelezi, as well as conservative white groups who did not want apartheid to end. There was lots of rhetoric from de Klerk and the ANC about finding a way for all South Africans to be equal and live in peace and harmony. The white South Africans were told that they were voting for equality, which is something they deemed important, as they did not wish to rule over the blacks, but simply wanted to preserve their culture and way of life. With a huge increase in terrorist bombings and severe pressure from the rest of the world closing in on them, the populace grew tired of the apartheid state and longed for an end to this, as they considered that the world might open their arms to them again. They did not know that they were voting for their own genocide. If they had known this, they most certainly would not have voted for their inevitable fate of mass killings and rapes. And so convinced they had no other option, the whites of South Africa essentially handed over control of their country to the ANC in 1994. South Africa had moved from the system of apartheid to one of majority rule. Following the election of April 27, 1994, Nelson Mandela was sworn in as South Africa's president, its cabinet made up of 12 ANC representatives, 6 from the National Party and 3 from the Inkatha Freedom Party. Thabo Mbeki and F.W. de Klerk were made deputy presidents. The world rejoiced at the end of apartheid. We were told that South Africans were going to be living hand in hand in a wonderful rainbow nation. But while blacks appeared to rule, it was Jews in key positions. When Nelson Mandela's ANC took over South Africa, Slobo was named Minister of Housing, Helena Dolny, the Jewish ex-wife of Slobo, ran the land bank, Ronnie Casserolls, a Jew, was the Minister of Water Affairs and Forestry, Louis Tager, a Jew, was chairman of the railway system, Spornet, Michael Katz, a Jew, was the chief consultant on taxation. Mayor Kahn, a Jew, was the managing director of the police service. 3 Jews, Richard Goldstone, Arthur Chaskalson, and Albert Sachs, sat on the South African Supreme Court. Immediately, the government embarked on the Reconstruction and Development Program to address what they deemed socioeconomic consequences of apartheid, which really just meant a major operation in wealth redistribution, translating to whites having their small bit of wealth stolen from them and given to blacks. This program was really just an affirmative action policy for the majority of the population, black Africans. Even though whites were the minority, they were oppressed, and blacks, along with other non-white races, were given a leg up over the white minority who were now being targeted for extinction. The Constitution of the Republic of South Africa was established in 1996. Mandela's government also established a criminal law code on the European model, abolition of the death penalty, and excessive rights for accused criminals with destructive results. South Africa today competes with Civil War-torn Colombia for the dubious distinction of being the world's most crime-ridden country. Interpol's international crime statistics say it all. In 1999, South Africa had 121 murders and 119, mostly white women, rapes per 100,000 inhabitants, compared with Colombia's 69 and 6 respectively, and the United States 5 and 32. The trends are no more encouraging considering that in 1994, the world's average murder rate was 5.5 per 100,000 compared to South Africa's 45. In such circumstances, and with a slow justice system which only produces a 10% conviction rate, South Africa has seen the rise of vigilante groups filling the void left by an incompetent and violent police, who between the 3 years of 1997 and 2000 killed 1,550 people, compared with 2,700 killed by the apartheid regime in 30 years. This is what the saintly Nelson Mandela helped to usher in. After one term as president, he stepped down in 1999, though he still served as an icon around the world for tolerance and diversity, since all of his crimes before and after coming to power were swept under the rug in the mass media. Mandela was followed by other radicals who oversaw the destruction of a once beautiful and safe South Africa, such as Thabo Mbeki from 1999 to 2008. Kalima Molampe for less than a year, and Jacob Zuma ever since. It was Zuma who announced the death of Nelson Mandela in December 2013. World leaders from all over flew into South Africa to congregate and mourn with Zuma. While the media cried about the loss of such a hero for civil rights, since then Mandela has essentially been deified by those who never say anything of his terrorist past, or the genocidal policies he implemented. Of course, not making it to the TV screens of the world were the songs of Kill the Boer, Kill the Racist, that continue to be sung by Zuma and his followers. Zuma is known for being an extremely corrupt leader. He was charged with rape in 2005, but was acquitted. He fought a long legal battle over allegations of racketeering and corruption, which resulted in his financial advisor, Shabir Shaikh's conviction for corruption and fraud. On April 6, 2009, the National Prosecuting Authority dropped the charges, citing political interference, although the decision has been challenged by opposition parties, and as of 2016, the matter is still before the courts. After extensive state-funded upgrades to his rural homestead at Nkandla, the public protector found that Zuma had benefited improperly from the expenditure, and the Constitutional Court unanimously held in 2016's Economic Freedom Fighters versus Speaker of the National Assembly that Zuma had failed to uphold the country's constitution, resulting in calls for his resignation and a failed impeachment attempt in the National Assembly. This is par for the course of South African governance in the post-apartheid era. Corruption is rampant at all levels, from the politicians to the police. The police are comprised of mostly black Africans who are hostile towards whites and treat the whites unfavorably. They do not care about solving crimes committed against white people or in stopping black-on-black violence either, and are simply opportunists looking to gain riches easily. Just as any concerned citizen under attack would do, the whites will call the police when they are being broken into or stolen from. But the police are just as corrupt as the thieves. They will cover for the criminals and look the other way while whites are being targeted. Now the country has regressed to third world status in a matter of years. The situation only continues to get worse for all residing in South Africa. South Africa went from being a beautiful first world country with top-of-the-line hospitals and a very high standard of living for not only whites, but blacks as well, to a third world hellhole. Before the end of apartheid, work was plentiful for both blacks and whites. Their streets were safe. Now everything is falling apart. Due to enforced affirmative action laws where non-whites are given preferential treatment, despite their capabilities to perform the job, South Africa has experienced a rapid decline in all of its industries, military, and infrastructure, with rolling blackouts where the power will be shut off for hours at a time. This happens almost daily. This is now commonplace in black-run South Africa, posing yet another security risk to South Africans. If white South Africans have a bit of money, they can barricade themselves behind electric fences and barbed wire to protect themselves from home invasions. But during a rolling blackout, which happens very frequently, these fences are rendered useless, as are the security systems. Some of the most horrific and unimaginable horrors take place when they are vulnerable like this, especially since gun laws make it virtually impossible to obtain a firearm. Without these security measures, the whites are sitting ducks. Whites are being murdered in the most sadistic and sickening ways imaginable. They are not just killed, but are tortured for days. For example, a group of blacks will wait for the children to come home from school and will tie the children up. Once the mother arrives at home, they will tie her up as well. They will wait for the father to come home and then tie him up also. They will then begin to torture and rape the mother and children in front of the father while he is tied up, unable to help. They will pour hot oil on the children, rape them with broken bottles, disembowel them, and light them on fire. They will often leave the father alive, so he has to live with these horrific images replaying through his mind for the rest of his life.
Around 3 o'clock in the morning, suddenly there was, "Mama, I need your help," at our bedside.
Bev sleeps in her clothes because she expects to be woken up at any time.
It's no longer coming home in a serene place where just everything falls off.
I'm coming home on a beautiful day, sun is shining.
I have friends who are nervous about coming to my house.
And every single window is locked. Two doors in front are locked.
stay locked in my room if I'm alone. I don't go outside.
They broke through the glass on this window, trying to get out as fast as they could.
I opened my eyes, switched on my pedestal light, and looked into the face of a man.
Four men wearing balaclavas in big, thick clubs.
I didn't have a front door.
Looking up at me like this.
He was lying flat on the ground.
He held my wrist very strongly.
I went to my son, and it took a while to realize that he was bleeding.
I recognized the voices, but they also recognized me.
And I think at that point, this bell was ringing, I was screaming, you were hitting, the alarm was blaring, time was ticking.
He had this gash on his cheek, and I tried to stop it bleeding.
They came to kill Craig.
No matter how hard I pushed it, it just would not stop.
And to rape me.
And I think, 5-10 minutes, it stopped moving.
There are an estimated 50 plus murders per day in South Africa. These are not crimes of opportunity. The majority of the time, the blacks will not steal one single item. The whites are not just murdered because they want their farms or property, but they are murdered simply due to a severe hatred toward the white people, and it involves torture, humiliation, and rape. The white farmers are the ones who are particularly targeted. They are more easily targeted than the other whites because most of the time they live in isolation and are far away from any neighbors that could intervene. Another reason for some of the horrors inflicted upon the innocent white children of South Africa is that the witch doctors of the African tribes will actually tell their people that in order to cure AIDS, they need to rape white babies, and the blacks actually do this. It is not just the incredible amount of murder that is leading to the genocide of whites in South Africa, but the anti-white policies mentioned already. White men were forced from their jobs first, but soon after, the white women were not able to get jobs either. With no help from the world and no jobs to make a living, many of these impoverished whites were forced into squatter camps, where they live in makeshift shacks on top of a trash heap. The squatter camps that the whites are forced to live in are some of the worst conditions you can imagine. The government has provided them with only a few steel walls to erect a small structure, although these structures have no windows, ventilation, or flooring. 300 plus people have to share one outhouse and one water spigot. They are unable to grow any food for themselves due to the drought and lack of clean water. They are given no help from their government or from the UN and other humanitarian groups. Babies are born on top of a trash heap with hardly any food to eat.
What is your name?
John.
John, John, how old are you?
11 years old.
11 years old. I hear that you had a break-in in your home.
Yes, they steal my bike and my dad's generators and his stool.
They stole your bike, generator, and your stool. So now you don't have a bicycle anymore.
Yes.
How did you feel when they broke in?
I was very sad. They're stealing my bike, and I was very sad.
You were very sad. Oh, I'm so sorry that happened to you. Were you scared?
Yes.
Oh, no. Well, I thank you for talking to me, and we'll try and make a plan and see if we can't find you a new bicycle.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, sweetheart. Hi, what is your name?
Hendriku.
Hendriku, how old are you?
15, about 16 this year.
This year, okay. Hendriku, how do you feel about what's going on in South Africa as a young person growing up here?
Well, to be honest, I'm actually scared of what my future is going to be like.
Is it? Why do you say that?
There's too much black people and not enough white people. This kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And why does it affect you so much? Is it because of the violence and the farm murders and the home invasions?
Yes.
How do you feel about the farmers that are being butchered like this?
It makes me angry.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want it to happen to everyone, except that they must stop killing us, they must stop helping us and not want to kill us.
And how do you feel about the education in South Africa?
There must also be enough education for the blacks as there are for the whites.
You want the same equal opportunities, is that what you're trying to say?
Yes.
Okay. How is your home life? Does your dad work?
No, he's...
He lost his job?
Yes, February.
In February, oh, that's awful. So, I presume you guys suffer and struggle with food every day?
Yes.
How do you feel when you see your parents struggle to support you guys?
It makes me sad.
What do you want to be when you grow up?
A motor mechanic.
A motor mechanic, wow. Do you think that you'll find a job in South Africa after studies?
No.
Why do you say that?
Because the black people are taking over all the jobs in this country.
So you see no future for yourself here?
Yes.
And if given the opportunity, would you, after your studies maybe, would you want to go and live and work in another country?
No.
No?
I'd rather work here, but if I must, I will go with
you. Yes. Okay. Thank you so much for talking to me, and I wish your family all the best of luck.
The squatter camps are often flooded during the rainy season, which renders their small structures useless. When people are told about the conditions that these whites are forced to live in, they tell them that they either deserve it or that they should just leave if they don't like it. These people don't even have enough money to buy a loaf of bread, let alone a plane ticket to a new country, or enough money to start a new life for themselves. There are an estimated 80 white squatter camps in the Pretoria area alone.
We are fighting for our language, we are fighting for jobs. So my feeling is that we are only fighting all the time to survive.
Across South Africa as a whole, there are an estimated 400,000 whites living in these conditions. Census figures suggest an estimated 8,000 white households live in shacks. Since the world has fallen silent on this ongoing genocide, the white South Africans have nowhere to go and are forced to rot away without food, water, safety, or shelter. Genocide Watch has declared genocide in South Africa, and the whites are currently in stage 6. There are only 8 stages. Black students are burning down their universities and attacking white students for colonizing their education. White students are attacked and harassed just for attending university. These whites are facing complete extinction, and the world has turned its back on them. There is a complete media blackout when it comes to the genocide in South Africa. Only a few brave outlets dare to cover this situation. The powers that be wish for this bloodbath to be kept in the dark so that white people around the world won't learn the truth and try to help, or even realize that what is happening in South Africa is now coming to their own doorstep. The powers that be have the exact same fate in store for every single white country. This is not just about annihilating whites from South Africa, but exterminating whites off the face of this earth for good. This plan has been stated by many in their own words.
I think there's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be part of the throes of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
And the one idea is how we are going to exterminate white people, because that, in my estimation, is the only conclusion I have come to. We have to exterminate white people off of the face of the planet to solve this problem.
There are two issues at the top of our agenda at the very moment. One is the unbelievably important immigration debate in this country, to make sure that immigrants from around the world, particularly those from south of our border, have a chance here.
My concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression, sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression, and it is not. There can be no white race.
Essentially, what you're saying is that in this boat, you're together with both Muslims
yes.
And people of other nations.
And we see ourselves together, fighting together with our Muslim brothers who want a free Europe, who want a peaceful Europe, who want to integrate like our forefathers integrated in Western Europe 100 and 200 years ago, and they are our natural allies.
Quel est l'objectif? Ça va faire parler. Mais l'objectif, c'est relever le défi du métissage. Défi du métissage que nous adresse le 21e siècle. Ce n'est pas un choix. C'est une obligation. C'est un impératif. On ne peut pas faire autrement.
AJC has always worked on the premise that as a minority, our security, our strength, our well-being in America is interdependent with those of other minorities. This is a Jewish issue. It is very much a Jewish issue.
The Honourable Gentleman says that he's going to take in 20,000 refugees over 5 years. The Germans took in 10,000 on one day. What kind of comparison is that? I recognize the financial problems. I recognize the assimilation problems. But if we don't do it now, we will live to regret it for the rest of our lives. The message from my constituents in a huge postbag and in every event I attended in my constituency the weekend is, let them in.
There's a second thing in that black box, an unrelenting stream of immigration. Non-stop. Fewer than 50% of the people in America from then and on will be white European stock. That's not a bad thing. That's a source of our strength.
Instead of taking in the very people who need refugee status the most, Europe has taken in millions of Arab and Black African men of fighting age. These are not refugees. They are an invading army that is being used by world Jewry as a communist proxy army to do the dirty work for them, so that they can place blame solely on the Arabs and Black Africans as they remain hidden behind the scenes, pulling the strings. They are inciting an invasion and anti-white violence in America, as well as at the same time employing affirmative action policies to discriminate against whites, who now make up a minority of the births. Whereas whites once had a high standard of living in our lands and were able to flourish in a safe environment, we have since been thrown under the bus by our own governments, who we thought were there to safeguard our interests. The time is now. We have got to raise awareness about the ongoing white genocide in South Africa, as well as the earthwide white genocide taking place in every corner of the world. Share this video with everyone you know. Take to the streets and let the world know about this hidden genocide. Go to whiteresistance.org for free activist material. Demand action from your politicians. Let the world know about this best-kept secret. Together, we can stop the biggest genocide ever attempted in history. Separate, we are weak. But united, we can accomplish anything.